You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Daniel Vinson, and I'm here on behalf of Dwayne E. Robinson, the appellant in this case. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This is a case involving the misapplication of the almost 100-year-old case, Massey v. Firmstead, to the evidence presented by the plaintiff, where the trial court incorrectly granted the defendant's motion to strike plaintiff's evidence. The underlying claim involves malicious prosecution, which, as with any malicious prosecution case, is very fact-specific. A quick recitation of the facts. This malicious prosecution involves three separate criminal charges brought against plaintiff, which were initiated by the defendant, dating back to December 26th of 2013. Was the offense date of a brandishing charge that was related to an encounter that the plaintiff had with defendant's son in the woods behind plaintiff's house. And January 20th of 2014, there were two curse and abuse charges that was related to an altercation between the plaintiff and the defendant, in which the defendant's sons were named the victims. The following day, January 21st, a warrant and the two summons were obtained by defendant against the plaintiff. The standard of review when looking at a case where the trial court granted a motion to strike is reviewed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. And when the sufficiency of the plaintiff's evidence is challenged by a motion to strike, the trial court should resolve any reasonable doubt as to the sufficiency of the evidence in the plaintiff's favor. Now, specifically, I think the elements of a malicious prosecution case are undisputed, and they're fairly succinctly laid out by Riley v. Shepard. The prosecution must be malicious, instituted by or with the cooperation of the defendant, in which there was no probable cause, and the criminal case being terminated in a manner not unfavorable to the plaintiff. Now, I think at this juncture, it's important, given the trial court's ruling in granting the defendant's motion to strike, to discuss the trial court's mentions of Massey v. Firmstone. Specifically, I'm not submitting to the court that the trial court's statements regarding Massey v. Firmstone are incorrect as a matter of law. I just don't believe that they were correctly applied to the evidence that was presented in this case. The language that I would like to draw your attention to is specifically located in the joint appendix on page 217 and 218. The trial court stated, if you call someone who is adverse to your case, such as the other party, you're bound by so much of their testimony that it's credible and is not contradicted by other evidence that the plaintiff may put on. And the court continued, it means that if you call the other party as a witness and they say things that are basically not helpful to your case, and you have not rebutted them in some fashion or another, you are in fact bound by that testimony as long as the testimony is credible to the trier of fact. Now, in making the court's ruling, the court did not articulate any evidence upon which it relied in granting this motion to strike. It did briefly and generally mention the testimony of the defendant and the defendant's son, but did not articulate any specifics. Now, I think Massey v. Firmstone, as it's applied to this case, can be summed up when the court said, as a general rule, when two or more witnesses introduced by a party litigant vary in their statements of fact, such party has the right to ask the court or jury to accept as true statements most favorable to him. In such a situation, he would be entitled to have the jury instructed upon this contention, or if there were a demur to the evidence, the facts would have to be regarded as established in accordance with the testimony most favorable to him. This is not true, however, as to the testimony which he gives himself. No litigant can successfully ask the court or jury to believe that he has not told the truth.
In other words, Massey doesn't apply where there's conflicting evidence within your case in chief, unless, of course, the litigant, him or herself, presents the evidence.
Correct, Your Honor.
So putting aside the Massey error and going to the question, tell me if I'm understanding the point. It seems simple. Could a rational fact finder conclude that the complaining party did not have probable cause for any of the three of these charges? Not was there probable cause or was there not probable cause, but could a rational fact finder conclude there was not probable cause?
And I think the evidence that was presented by the plaintiff, both in his own direct testimony together with the testimony of the defendant and the defendant's son, in my opinion, conclusively established that there was no probable cause. But at the very least, there would be a question of fact that should be resolved by the fact finder, in this case, the jury. And the Riley v. Shepard case also pretty succinctly lays out the court's consideration when determining whether or not there's probable cause for purposes of malicious prosecution case. The courts define probable cause as knowledge of such state of facts and circumstances as excite the belief in a reasonable mind acting on such facts and circumstances that the plaintiff is guilty of the crime which he is suspected. And this is to be ascertained by the trier of fact as of the time that the complained actions were taken. Now, in looking at the element of without probable cause, I think it's important to separate the two sets of charges from the two alleged defense dates, the first being the brandishing from December 26th of 2013, and the second being the curse and abuse from January 20th of 2014. The relevant portion of the brandishing statute, 18.282, states that it shall be unlawful for any person to point, hold, or brandish any firearm in such a manner as to reasonably induce fear in the mind of another. Now, in looking at the plaintiff's testimony directly, specifically through appendix page 26 and 27, the plaintiff testified that he was hunting that day. He approached the defendant. The defendant called the children inside. He observed two children leaving the woods. He believed the area to be clear of children because the defendant only had two children living with her. He further testified on appendix page 27, that he was carrying the shotgun by the receiver in a non-threatening manner. He heard hunting dogs running toward the back end of his property. He racked his shotgun, and at that point, he saw Alexander Huron, the defendant's son, out of the corner of his eye. Now, this fact that there was no probable cause when the defendant obtained these charges against the plaintiff is further supported by the defendant's own testimony when she was called by the plaintiff at trial, specifically appendix pages 145 through 147. She stated that specifically, and I quote, "Mr. Robinson did not even realize he was there. He specifically, speaking of her son, specifically told me that he had seen Mr. Robinson. Her son heard him chamber around and a shotgun and then said hello. He wanted to make sure Mr. Robinson knew he was there. He didn't want to surprise him. He said hello and made himself known and got his attention specifically." Now, these statements, or this testimony by the defendant as to her knowledge at that point, I think are critical because in looking at the brandishing statute under 18.282, one cannot intentionally point, hold, or brandish a firearm so as to reasonably induce fear if that person is not aware of the other person's presence. And I think the case law to this is a little unclear, but I attempted to ascertain whether or not this court has ever specifically indicated whether brandishing was a general intent or specific intent crime. I couldn't find a clear-cut answer to that question. Based off of my knowledge of the issue, I would ascertain that it's a general intent crime. But under either scenario, the awareness of the presence of another person is key. It's a little bit clearer of an analysis if brandishing is determined to be a specific intent crime. You can't specifically intend to reasonably induce fear in another if you're unaware of the presence of another. Now, a little less clear, if brandishing is ascertained to be a general intent crime, I still don't believe you can knowingly and voluntarily undertake an action to reasonably induce fear in another if you're unaware of their presence. That is why the defendant's testimony acknowledging specifically the plaintiff was unaware of the son's presence is so key here. If she was aware of that, then she was aware that there was no probable cause to ascertain the brandishing warrant in the first place. Now, jumping to the curse and abuse, the Massey v. Firmstone analysis is a little more directly applicable here because both the plaintiff and the defendant were present together during these interactions. Now, the plaintiff specifically testified that he never spoke to or even saw the defendant's children that day. Now, this is important in bringing charges under the curse and abuse statute 18.2 416 because that particular statute requires that the curse or abusive language be directed specifically at the victims, in this case, the defendant's two children. How can the plaintiff specifically direct cursing or abusive language to two victims that he's unaware of their presence? I think also generally applying to both the brandishing and the curse and abuse charges in reference to the element of lack of probable cause, there's some testimony and evidence in the record that can speak to both of them. I think it's significant that the brandishing charge wasn't obtained until 26 days after the events, specifically after the altercation between the parties in this case. And the defendant testified that on January 20th of 2014, I approached Mr. Robinson in his driveway, and this was in response to plaintiff's counsel question as to why she obtained these warrants and summons 26 days after the brandishing events. And her response was, I approached Mr. Robinson in his driveway and tried to speak with him and tried to resolve it. He was extremely angry. He was cursing me out. He scared me even more. I realized his anger was getting worse, not better. I was scared. That's her response to the specific question is why she obtained the warrants and summons. Not because of a desire to see justice served. Not because she believed the defendant to be guilty of those crimes. She did it because she was scared. And I think that conclusively demonstrates by her own testimony that her actions were done without probable cause. And at this juncture, I've reserved the remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. I address the Honorable Court. I'm Dan Forbes, G. Daniel Forbes, from the wonderful Southampton County in the Fifth Circuit. My office is actually in Franklin. I represent the appellee, and my presentation will be a little bit disjunctive because of the nature of the case. Massey v. Ferguson confounds me a little bit because it arguably could stand for the premise that if I put on one unbelievable, incredible witness that says my client, the appellee, is guilty of malicious prosecution, but I proceed to put on tons of other evidence that says they are not, that one such statement could overcome all the other evidence.
Only for purposes of a motion to strike, though.
Yes, sir, but that's still a little bit unbelievable to me as a practicing lawyer. And you're talking about a situation where a trial judge sits there, he judges the credibility of the witnesses, he looks and hears all the evidence, and he's sitting there with his standard of, if this goes to the jury and further evidence is presented, will I be able to allow the verdict or will I have to set it aside? Keep in mind,
but our system presupposes that the citizens called into a citizen jury are to be more trusted with those credibility and those weight issues than any of us. That's the presupposition.
Yes, sir, I understand that.
So why wouldn't the standard that you find difficult be explained by simply an understanding that our tradition places that responsibility not on judges but on our citizens?
But our trial judges are given the task of judging the credibility of the witnesses.
Not on a motion to strike, they're not.
And I'm not attempting to be argumentative. I just don't see how they don't do that. Maybe by law they can't do it. Maybe they're supposed to, and they are supposed to presume that everything favorable to the plaintiff can be done in front of the plaintiff. But let me point out some other things that I think will help me. This is a state of mind case. And if you look at all the evidence, there is no contradiction in the evidence except for one thing. The appellant says, I didn't intend to to threaten him. I didn't intend to scare him. Alexander Urban went in the house and cried for hours. He was scared. So the transcript in the appendix will show that Mrs. Copeland, with her son Alexander Urban, U-R-A-N, went to the magistrate's office, wherein Alexander Urban told the magistrate what happened. And because he was a juvenile, Mrs. Copeland had to sign that. And she did sign a complaint based on what her son told him. But how does she know, or anybody else know, what was in Mr. Robinson's mind, except by what they observed? Chambering a bullet, or a shotgun shell, and saying, get the hell off my property. It obviously scared Alexander, and his mother was upset. Now,
was there any testimony, Mr. Forbes, that at the time he racked the shotgun, he was aware that Alexander was in the woods?
Your Honor, in reading the transcripts yesterday, the transcripts and the appendix ultimately would show that the testimony given was that he was out on his land hunting adjacent to the appellee's land, that he knew children had been out there. But even Alexander's testimony was that he wasn't sure he saw him.
Well, then how do you brandish a weapon at someone that you don't know is there?
When you turn around to him with a loaded shotgun and say, get the hell off my property.
He said he never did that.
But my client said he did, and it was the plainest evidence, so it contradicts. And you can judge it not by what he said, but by what his actions were. Now, let's keep in mind the reasonableness of what he's done. I don't know how many of you are familiar with deer hunters, but sometimes they think they're blessed by God to do anything they're supposed to do to kill a deer. These people live side by side in a 200-foot wide piece of land that goes all the way back forever. My client, the appellee, has a lot of woods. The appellant had a little bit of woods. And what he was doing was actually sitting back there waiting for another hunt club to run deer by his land. And so he was sitting out there hunting, and these kids were out playing paintball. And his argument in the case is essentially, they should stop playing so I can hunt. And when one of them walks up on him and says, hey, I'm here, he turns around and says, get the hell off my land. And he's got a chambered shotgun.
But there's no testimony he ever pointed the gun at the boy when he
I don't believe
around.
He did. But how, if you're in the woods and a man's standing there, you heard him rack the gun. How hard for him to pull it up. And you have to take into consideration all the facts and circumstances. If you look at the evidence, Alexander Urban was scared. He ran in the house and cried in his bed alone. And that's all his mother saw. But of course, one of my other arguments was, does one mere contradictory evidence trump all the other? And if I'm reading Your Honors correctly, on a motion to strike, it can. But I would submit to you that if you look at the totality of the case, the trial judge sat there and realized he couldn't allow a verdict to stand if it was given in this case. And essentially, all the evidence had been put on. Now, I know procedurally we were at a motion to strike, but there wasn't any more evidence. I believe the appellant's counsel questioned my client for an hour and a half. Then questioned my client's son the same way. And I wasn't even going to put him back on. Of course, nobody knew that at the time. But he had essentially heard all the evidence in the case. And that might not make any difference on a motion to strike.
Well, the citizens that would have showed up at that trial would have all been from Southampton, and they would have been very aware of the culture of deer hunting, whereas the designate judge came from Portsmouth, and there's not that much deer hunting in Portsmouth. So couldn't you rely upon the Southampton citizens to cut through the fog of this case and figure out what's really happening? And what's wrong with requiring me to do that?
Your Honor, I'm going to give you a straight answer. I wish I had. Simply because they would have found no verdict for the appellant and we'd be done. My clients wouldn't be spending all this money.
Next time, don't make a motion to strike.
Yes, well, then I would hear your chastising for that also. But I just think the judge was in a can't-win situation. I mean, if you read the transcript, he almost asked Mr. Randall to declare adverse witnesses. He didn't do it. And I have always labored under the impression if you put them on as your witnesses, you're bound by their testimony. And I understand that Massey v. Ferguson says if there's contradictory evidence, favorable, that trumps. No pun intended. And that's really all I've got to argue about. It's a really simple fact and circumstance case. And there may be need to elaborate on Massey v. Ferguson, but I would submit that the trial judge did what he thought was correct and interpreted the law correctly. Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. There's been a lot of discussion as to Massey v. Ferguson, and I think given the trial court statements and its ruling, it's appropriate.
Massey v. Firmstone.
Firmstone, excuse me. I think it was, he relied on it. It was pretty clear in reviewing his rulings. But the real issue here, and I think that was highlighted by Your Honors, is the case was taken out of the trier of fact's hands. There was more than ample evidence to, at the very worst, create a legitimate question of fact that should have been determined by the jury, not on a motion to strike. And just specifically addressing several of appellate counsel's arguments, I don't think it's relevant whether or not Alexander came in the house crying, scared, and upset for hours. That's the result. The testimony was clear that any overt action, specifically racking or chambering around in the shotgun, was done without the knowledge of the child's presence. So just because the child was scared and crying, that's not sufficient to establish probable cause to bring a brandishing charge, specifically when the defendant acknowledged by her own testimony that she was aware that the plaintiff didn't see the child. Now, I'm not entirely sure why Mr. Forbes believes that declaring the defendant or her son as adverse witnesses changes the analysis at all. And their evidence is what their evidence is. The plaintiff is, in this argument, seeking to be bound by their testimony. I think the defendant and her son testimony conclusively established plaintiff's argument that there was no probable cause when they brought these criminal charges against him. So, on that note, Your Honors, I would conclude, and I would ask that you remand this case back to the Southampton Circuit Court and allow the matter to be retried on the merits to the trier of fact. Thank you.
Call the next case.